Good morning, everybody. I'm Howard Spivak. I'm moderating the session and doing the first presentation. Thank you all for coming. I will say last year we did this a similar session on this, and the room was overflowing, so this year they gave us a cavern to do it in. So if anyone wants to move closer, they're more than welcome to. This is a session on health in criminal and juvenile justice policy. We have four speakers. I'm going to start by presenting some of the health and scientific elements that are relevant to policy. And the order of speakers after that is changed from what's in the program. The second speaker will be Bob Lissenby, who's the administrator of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, who's going to be talking about policy pretty much at a national level, followed by Theron Pride, who's Chief of Staff in the Office of Justice Programs at the Justice Department. He'll be sort of the transition from national to local and talking about some of the programs that link national work with cities and localities. And then the final presentation will be by Harold Pollack, who's co-director of the University of Chicago Crime Lab. He'll be talking about some specific elements in a program in Chicago itself, so that we bring it down to ground level. Each person will speak about 10 minutes or so, which should leave a fair amount of time for questions and comments and discussion. So first of all, here's my disclosure form. I have nothing to report, and actually neither Bob nor Theron have slides, so count this slide as for them too as well, since neither of them have disclosures. So what I'd like to do is lay out a bit of the science behind that's been driving policy in criminal justice and in most specifically in juvenile justice. And I want to preface this by saying that some of this science is fairly old, but what's new about it is that the technology that's actually defining the neurodevelopmental and brain development elements of this that really substantiate what we've known for a long time about adolescent and young adults in terms of how they think and how that affects the behavior is somewhat new. And in fact, it's really been only in the last decade or two that the real neuroscience and the neuroimaging that we've been able to do has actually been able to document and help us better understand what's behind some of what we've known for longer. I think it's extremely important to recognize that brain development goes on for a fairly long time and is fairly active, at least into the mid-20s. When I started medical school some years ago, I've stopped counting, we were actually taught that most brain development was done in the first 3 to 4 years of life, and then it was pretty much over. So you really had to do everything up front. And that led to some rather interesting phenomena, including pregnant women playing Mozart to their bellies, thinking that that somehow was going to improve the intellectual development of their kids before they were born. But in fact, what we do know is that there's a fair amount of development that goes on for a long period of time. And in fact, during adolescence, in early adolescence, the brain goes through a growth spurt, which was not really understood until, again, relatively recently. And the organization of neuropathways, which is really important in terms of cognitive functioning and judgment, as I said, goes in well into the mid-20s. And the last part of brain development is really in the frontal lobe area, which is where executive function is, so that even though people have a lot of information well before that period, their ability to do sophisticated judgment and decision making is not fully developed or as advanced as people used to think until mid-20s. And I heard somebody recently sort of give the analogy of the fact of a car being built and actually moving along the road, but the driver isn't experienced or ready to actually drive the car. And that's essentially what the dynamic is. The last thing I want to say about this is that intellectual capacity and executive function are not the same thing. People can be extremely smart. Kids in high school can have the most sophisticated discussions, filled with knowledge and expertise. But then after class is over, they'll get into their cars and drive down the road and cross an intersection with cars coming from the other direction and just assume they can make it. And then when a crash happens and the other driver gets out and says, "What did you do? Weren't you thinking?" The answer is no, they weren't thinking. Because, in fact, their ability to make those kinds of judgments is not fully developed. There's a second element of this which is particularly important for early and mid-adolescence, and that is the biological changes that are also happening during this period. There's huge fluctuation in hormonal releases during adolescence that has effects not just on body growth and sexual development, but it has effects on the brain itself, and in particular on emotional functioning in the brain, so that adolescents have huge mood swings, can go into depression on any given day and then the next day seem perfectly fine. That's a very disorienting kind of state to be in. The other thing is that teenagers often look in the mirror in the morning and don't know what to expect to see because their bodies are changing so rapidly as well. And so their physical appearance is changing, their hormonal releases are affecting their moods and their emotions, and they're just going through a huge amount of change, which greatly affects their behavior as well. There's also social developmental factors that are important to consider with respect to the behavior of adolescents and young adults. Young people are moving from their family structure, where parents and family guidelines are very much influencing their behavior, to an increased external environment where peer influence is actually more powerful and more important than family rules and family structure. They're rebelling, they're risk-taking, which is both part of their neurodevelopmental process as well as their social developmental process. And young people often behave very differently around their friends than they do when they're alone. So when they're with a group of peers and there's peer pressure influencing their behavior, their risk-taking, if anything, becomes even more dramatic and more unpredictable. And the last point I want to make about brain development, which is really important, especially for the highest risk kids growing up in inner cities, is the effects of exposures that they have during their earlier development. It's been well documented that exposure to violence early in one's life has considerable effects, not just on behavior, but actually on brain architecture itself. And in fact, again, well documented by neuroimaging, the biggest effect of these exposures seems to be in the temporal lobes, where there's a very different pattern of temporal lobe development in kids who have experienced stress and recurrent episodes of exposure to violence. If you look at the neuroimaging of brains of kids who, for example, have experienced abuse versus kids who have not, the temporal lobes in kids who have not experienced abuse, their temporal lobes light up and there's lots of activity there. If you look at the temporal lobe activity in kids who have experienced abuse, there's very little activity going on there. Now, this is particularly important because the temporal lobes are the part of the brain that regulate emotions. So when you have a maldevelopment of the area of the brain that affects moods, affects affect, affects temperament, you can expect, again, fairly unpredictable behaviors. We also know that rates of post-traumatic stress disorder among kids who live in inner city communities rival rates of post-traumatic stress disorder of people coming back from combat zones in the military. Post-traumatic stress disorder has huge effects on behavior. They affect how people perceive what's going on in their environment. They tend to be hypervigilant. They tend to misread verbal and behavioral cues. They tend to see the world as a dangerous and mean place, and therefore often will interpret a relatively neutral situation as something other than neutral and something far more threatening. So when we hear about interactions between police and young people, especially young people in inner cities, and we see these interactions going in difficult directions, it shouldn't be terribly surprising, given the long-term effects of the exposures and the environments that these kids have grown up in. So in closing, there are neurodevelopmental, biological, socio-developmental factors, all of which influence decision-making, executive function, and need to be considered when one thinks about how young people are treated and responded to in the criminal justice system. Superimposed on that, in the context of young people who grow up in neighborhoods that are violent and have high stress factors, are all the more at risk for this. And criminal justice policy and the manner in which young people are treated and responded to are very much influenced, or should be very much influenced, by these biological and developmental and environmental factors. So on that note, I'm going to pass things on to Bob to talk about national policy.